Search for a Lost Tribe of Indians in the Amazon Jungle is the story you'll hear 3 minutes from now. This is Monitor. I'm your host, Ted Steele. Here's one of the most popular sounds of the day, the Tijuana Brass with Casino Royale. That note. The Waika Indians are a primitive and isolated tribe living in the Amazon jungle. They had never had contact with white men until three young Americans went on a dangerous and difficult trip to their remote jungle village. Two of these young explorers, Fred A. Salazar and Jack Kirschlag, have written a book titled The Innocent Assassins. Monitor reporter Charlie Holmes interviewed Fred Salazar about his experiences in the jungle.
Fred Salazar, how did you meet the Waika Indians?
Well, we'd travel for days and going into weeks looking for the Waika. We knew they were there. When we eventually came up to the village, only the Waika braves approached us with drawn bows and arrows. This went on for about 15 minutes of them standing in front of us, so maybe a half an hour looking at us, we're looking at them, and eventually we started giving out gifts, and this sort of broke it right away, you know. These seven particular groups had never seen a white man before.
And you actually traded trinkets to become
friends? We traded regular trinkets, boxes of matches, razor blades, tobacco, knives, that type of thing, but no whiskey and no guns, which is one of the things that most white men carry into the jungle and sort of ruin the Indian.
Would you say these Indians were cannibals?
They are cannibals to a sense. They have a cannibalistic right. They don't eat the flesh, but they do eat the burnt body and what's left of the bones. They smash it up and make sort of a pudding out of it. Eat it with this mandioca on a banana leaf and hand it out to the immediate members of the family. But this is the reason they do this now is, again, they believe that the body of the dead must return to the body of the living. But they don't eat it for the reason that a number of other cannibal tribes in the world would eat flesh for.
In other words, this is a kind of a religious rite.
This is a religious rite.
Is this the only touch of religion you noticed among these tribes?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that their religion, these tribes, again, haven't gotten to the Bone Age. They're still in the Stone Age. They haven't learned to use stone implements at all. Fire is still a shock to them. They believe in every animal and every tree as a god. Your Waika haven't learned to use clothing yet or even loincloths. They are still in the stage where they're just using a little belt around the waist And the reason they wear that is because their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers wore it, but not for the reason of dress or covering.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 5 foot tall. I mean, in very rare cases, you'll see an Indian about 5 foot three or four.
How long do they live?
They live to be the age of about 30 or 40.
Why is tops. This?
Nutrition, and the lack of the right nutrition, I think. Mm-hmm. You've always got malnutrition in all of your small children. You'll see them with the large stomachs.
Would you say the Waika women were pretty at all?
Considering the other tribes in the nearby areas, yes, I think the Waika women were very pretty.
Are these particular people you were with warriors?
Yes, these were warriors, right.
Do they have any ceremonies when they go into war? Did you see that?
They don't have any ceremonies as we know it from American Indians, but they do get themselves doped up on a drug called Abana.
Mm-hmm.
Abana is a drug that puts them in, it's sort of an LSD drug. They feel 10,000 times their size, and they can go out and kill, come back, and really not feel sorry for it and not realize what they've done.
Been on a jag, in a sense. You became a friend of one Indian. Did you really bridge the gap? Did you become a real friend as we could understand it?
I don't think any white man can ever really become the friend of an Indian because he never really trusts you. And I don't think you ever really trust him down deep inside, no matter how much you try. You become a friend in the sense that you are friends to go out hunting and he'll hunt for you and, you know, sort of help you in certain ways. But a true friendship bond, I don't think you'll ever find that.
Why did you title your book The Innocent Assassins?
The white man has been killing off the Indians for over 150 years. And when I say the white man, I mean not only Americans, but Europeans and everyone else who goes in for their own reasons, mining or whatever have you. And they touch the Indian. They give him pots, knives, whiskey, guns. This right away changes him to the man who's dependent from then on. He's no longer proud in his own stage. He has to accept everything the white man is ready to give him. And then he learns, for instance, a very simple thing like greed. He doesn't know this before because every Indian has the same bow and arrow and the same hammock. Now, when a white man comes in and gives him a machete or a pot, the other man doesn't have one. He's going to kill or steal to get it.
I see. One final question. What makes you want to take these dangerous trips into the jungle territory?
Well, I think I've tried to bring across the point that the jungle is not as dank and dangerous as we've been hearing about for the last 50 or 100 years. To me, it's a paradise. I think I feel very free in the jungle. I don't feel regimented in any way, not that I'm fighting regimentation. But the jungle, I think, to me, has a serenity, and it offers a calmness that you'll never find in civilization.
Thank you, Fred Salazar, explorer and author, for telling us about your experiences in the jungle of the Amazon, as detailed in your book, The Innocent Assassins.
Thank you.
This is Charlie Holmes for Monitor.
The Raycon of Singers now, and 17.
17. We met at 17. Magic age, the best of all. Thank you.
world of space just about 2 minutes away on the Monitor Beacon. 20 minutes past the hour, they're playing our song. Yes, and the world of space, the current status of our program for future exploration, are dependent upon the all-important aspect of safety. Peter Hackus reports.
Astronaut Shiraz remarked the other day when he said, "We will fly the spacecraft when we, the crew, feel it is ready," is reassuring. Shiraz should be enough of an engineer, test pilot, and space flyer to know when a capsule is ready and safe. But then the Apollo 1 crew thought its capsule was ready and safe. And so did everyone else, safe at least for that particular test. There are those here in Washington who feel NASA should take another step to ensure future safety. Even to help the astronaut experts themselves, they say, it might be wise to set up an unofficial team of engineers to keep tabs on Apollo. Members of the group could be NASA experts, university people, Air Force, or possibly aerospace industry men. As individuals, they would be asked by NASA from time to time to make unannounced visits to Houston or to the capsule factory in California. Their job would not be to fire anyone, but to serve as devil's advocate. They would be constant skeptics, looking for trouble, and hopefully finding it before it harms the program. They would try to think the unthinkable about certain parts and systems and methods, challenging anything at all based on new thoughts, new discoveries, or new experiments. As an example of how this team might operate, take the revised Apollo capsule wiring system. What with new developments all the time, why couldn't an outside engineer be asked, paid for that matter, to study new wiring procedures? As time goes on, he might learn of new ways of coating wires with different insulations. He might learn of some exotic new method of eliminating certain wires by use of solid-state electronics. Or he might find out about some laboratory testing that shows there are better ways of splicing, marking, soldering, or threading wires. Unless one of these men is on the lookout for such developments, the Apollo team might not learn of them until much too late to change the capsule. These men would be asked to keep up on new paints, fabrics, metals, electronic components, optic discoveries, new ways of doing things, which up to now everyone had thought were correct. As astronaut director Deke Slayton told a House committee, there's no way of telling if even right now the ingredients of another tragedy might be building. There are those who feel NASA advisors should make constant updated challenges of every single Apollo subsystem, because the state of the art in space exploration changes so rapidly that what is an accepted practice today is outmoded tomorrow. The idea is worth looking into. Never again must any segment of Apollo become complacent or overconfident based on past success. There's just too much at stake. Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
And space is one of the areas we cover every week on Monitor. And now let's try our song. Jones in the field of music, one of the popular young singers. He sings More and More.
Heartache
A message here from the United Negro College Fund. The surest way a Negro youth can achieve economic equality is through education. And that's why the United Negro College Fund is important. It helps support 33 predominantly Negro colleges and universities. And that means 35,000 economically deprived students, all races, all creeds. If you want to help build equality of opportunity, give to the fund. Box 5552, Grand Central Station, New York City, 10017. Wanderly and Take Care of My Heart. In Trenton, New Jersey, we're heard on WBUD. Wherever you hear monitors, stay tuned. There's more to come. I'm your host, Ted Steele.
You're with the Now program for all seasons, Monitor, on the NBC Radio Network.
Keeping you informed of facts, keeping you informed of issues, keeping you informed of people. WNBC, the big voice of Big Town USA, keeps you informed of Big Town.
-67 degrees and clear in Big Town, the big voice of Big Town USA, WNBC New York.
A little thank you music next on Monitor. It's Donka Shane by Derek and Ray. Thank you, men. Frankie Lane on Monitor Now, making memories.
We're making memories each time we kiss, making wonderful memories when we are holding each other like this. Green dress for a pillow, a black velvet sky above, tender magic moments in a wonderland of love. The years may come and go, but we'll recall sharing love in our highway, and how this night was the start of it all. Darling,
Garagiola talks to a baseball star in this half hour of Monitor, and we'll hear some fascinating recollections of the famous people in the administration of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt from the author of a book about that chapter of American history. I'm your host, Ted Steele, and here are the Johnny Man Singers with Up, Up, and Away.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We can fly, we can fly. Up, up and away, my beautiful, my beautiful. La 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 la
30s in America meant movies with Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, Bank Night, Dish Night, the sudden popularity of miniature golf, the craze for Monopoly, Fred Allen on NBC Radio, Information Please, Amos and Andy. All that and more is recalled in a book titled Just Around the Corner, a highly selective history of the 30s. Monitor reporter Betty Grobley interviewed the author, Robert Bendiner.
Now, Robert, you suggest that there was not one depression during this time, but two. What do you mean by that?
Well, I characterize it, Betty, as the gloomy depression of Herbert Hoover, which was really unrelieved, and the exhilarating depression of Franklin D. Roosevelt, because actually the depression did continue for quite some years. But whereas the first had no hope at all in it, the second was not only full of hope to recover from the Depression itself, but really to constitute a new country. There was a sense of really vital change, such as you rarely get in the whole life history of a country.
What about some of the men that you discuss in your book, the colorful men of the New Deal?
Well, the interesting thing about the Roosevelt administration was that it was no one-man job. I mean, where Roosevelt was certainly all-pervasive and was the spirit of the thing, he didn't have just minor people around him. He had very real characters, and in fact, he loved them so much that he never really could get rid of them, even when they were clashing violently with each other, so that he always created new bureaus and new agencies and so on, or rather than get rid of the old ones. Well, there were people like the very cantankerous Harold Ickes, if you remember, who was, you know, fiercely honest believed absolutely that nobody else was. And there was Henry Wallace, of course, used to take his exercise in the morning with a boomerang and had interests in, theosophy and all kinds of mysticism on the side.
Some of the other people you mentioned, for instance, Huey Long, now what role did he play?
I remember Huey dancing a jig on the aisle of the Senate. He was dressed in a brown suit and a pink shirt, and he had brown and white shoes.
Why was he dancing a jig?
He was a very ebullient chap, and if he thought he had scored a point, he would think nothing of doing a little jig on the Senate aisle. He was, of course, regarded a little, about the middle of the decade, as a real threat, political threat. And he had his movement, which was Share the Wealth, and his song about every man a king and every girl a queen. And he had made a tremendous dent. And he had done a lot of good in Louisiana, but along with a lot of evil, a lot of mischief.
A lot of corruption.
Terrible. Not simply corruption, but tyranny, really, and, you know, vengefulness. And he was a very complex, a very mixed character.
And who was Father Coughlin?
Well, Father Coughlin started out as a very ardent supporter of the administration of Franklin Roosevelt, and he used to say, the president was practically a savior of the United States. But when the president didn't go far enough in the direction of cheap money and silver, particularly, Father Coughlin turned against him. And he had an enormous following. He had something like 30 or 40 million people who listened to his Sunday sermons, which were really political lectures rather than religious sermons as a rule. He gradually soured, and from being an ardent and radical supporter of the administration, he turned out to be an extremely intemperate foe, and he was, at the end of his career, he was actually sanctioning street gangs, called Christian mobilizers, so-called.
And
Christian
Townsend.
Front.
Now, what role did he play?
Well, Townsend had a rather simple formula for giving people at age 60 I think it was $200 a month. And this was
everybody
to be a revolving fund, and they had the only requirement was that you had to spend it within the next 30 days. And the theory was that this would so stimulate the economy that we would come out on top and we would, for the first time, take care of our old folks. And I must say, really, that while a lot of these suggestions, there were many others, were very crackpot and impossible, the goals were not. And in some, you know, strange way, the New Deal actually did realize in a more sane way the objectives of some of these people.
Mm. You can read about it. It's called Just Around the Corner, A Highly Selective History of the 30s by my guest, Robert Bendiener. This is Betty Grobley for Monitor.
Back to the 60s now, and one of the famous names in show business, Dean Martin. He sings Lay Some Happiness on Me. Before the hour, you're on the Monitor Beacon. Joe Garagiola, after Eddie Fisher sings Now I Know.
Now I know why I've been lonely. Now I know I needed you only. I was lost in the stars up above, till you gave me a world filled with love. Now I know life is worth living. Loving you has made it so. Darling.